Hi, this is Matthew Continetti of the Weekly Standard and the K Street Gang, the rise and fall of the Republican machine.
I'm Noam Schreiber, a writer with the New Republic magazine.
And we're here today to talk about the latest in politics. Noam, let's start with the ongoing Petraeus-Crocker hearings. Petraeus and General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker arrived in Washington. They spent all day on the Senate side of Congress. This morning they talked to the Senate Armed Services Committee, and I believe they're still talking to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee now. All three remaining presidential candidates have questioned Petraeus at this point. Barack Obama was the last one, too. And it was, of course, what struck me about the hearings, at least anyway, was how subdued they were, especially mm-hmm. the questions coming from Clinton and Obama. Also, more broadly, it seemed that most of the questions were less about Iraq per se, what you might, you know, the Iraq battle space, than kind of the larger context, as several senators put it, you know, whether that involved the region or even, especially on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, a lot of talk about the troubled American economy, mm-hmm. how that falls under General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker purview. There is a puzzle to me, but I was wondering mm-hmm. what your reaction was to the hearing so far.
Yeah, you know, I think you made a couple good points there. I was also struck by the subdued tone of the whole affair. I mean, I think given some of the events of the last year or so, Democrats have learned pretty well that Petraeus is not a guy who you want to be seen as sort of attacking head-on or grandstanding, you know, in the presence of. He's obviously very well respected among the public. And, you know, I think Obama probably had the additional task of demonstrating some foreign policy knowledge. He was sort of criticized last time for sort of having a long-winded kind of soliloquy rather than some useful questioning. And so I think his testimony or his questioning and his comments were partially a response to that. You know, I guess more broadly, my feeling about the testimony and the questioning I just feel like we sort of face this, both sides face these sort of kind of immovable dilemmas, which is McCain, you know, has a very, very coherent position, which is very unpopular. But it's very coherent, and, you know, he did concede today that there were these problems in Basra, and, you know, and it's unfortunate that the Maliki government went in sort of unprepared. But basically his position is, you know, the surge is pretty much working, and if we stay the course, you know, it'll probably continue to work, but we just can't lose our nerve. Whereas, you know, the Democrats, who basically have the same position, though Clinton was a little more strident about it today, have this idea that, you know, you can get out and sort of preserve some element of stability, even though it won't be perfect. But if we get out in 18 months, you know, things will work out well enough. They just won't, you know, they just won't be quite where the Bush administration maybe would have wanted them when it went in. And that seems to me sort of a politically appealing position, but a really substantively incoherent one. And it seems to me, you know, Petraeus and Crocker are basically right when they say, look, you know, it's not that we can sort of take the status quo that we have now and get out and it'll just stay that way, that it's going to require some more investment or considerable more investment in order to get something that's sort of self-sustaining. But obviously the Democrats have the advantage of that being a sort of politically, useful position to take. And I think I don't mean that in a sort of cynical way. I mean, I think the country really has sort of reached wits end for probably, good reasons. And Clinton talked a lot about opportunity costs, and I think they're significant. But in the narrow confines of their position about staying or going, there is a bit of incoherence there. And, you know, for all its faults, McCain's position is extremely coherent.
Right, I agree. I think one thing that struck me about these hearings in the current situation in Iraq is But we're kind of in a time warp now. Basically, the surge has taken us back to 2005 when it comes to levels of violence. So we're now, at least in military terms, the war is at where it was in 2005. Now, the situation is better than, I think, than it was in 2005 because we saw the flipping of the Sunnis from a de facto alliance with al-Qaeda in Iraq to basically working with the coalition and trying to integrate them somehow with the central government. We've seen, the benchmarks 12 of 18, the benchmarks have been met. Not all of them legislative, but we've had this package of legislation that's come out in the past month or so. So we're basically, speaking in terms of the military operations, they were back where we were in 2005, and politically we're actually better than we were in 2005. However, the Democrats' rhetoric on Iraq is still stuck in 2006. I mean, it's still kind of stuck with this idea that that the war is lost, or if it's not lost, then it's interminable. And that's another thing I think we could detect in kind of the hearings, is this whole idea of an interminable commitment, and basically the Congress's rejection of that, at least the Senate's rejection of that from most of the Democrats who talked, and even on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, a lot of Republicans. So the problem in the general election campaign will be kind of McCain's coherent position, as you called it, but also saying that you need to move forward since we've stepped back from the brink in Iraq thanks to the surge and the change in policy. Now the question is, how do we build on the security situation as it was in 2005 and a better political situation than then? But how do we build from that? Whereas the Democrats do seem committed, though, to this idea that, withdraw first and then see what happens after.
I sort of accept the analogy of 2005, broadly speaking. I think you could quibble with it, but basically I think you're right that the world has changed since Democrats became wedded to a sort of withdrawal plan, and there's no question that we're making some progress. I think for Democrats, where I would disagree with you is that I don't necessarily see that we're not in a sort of interminable commitment. I mean, I think with the sort of boss operation, whatever Petraeus's sort of rationale for why it didn't work out, this was the wrong, division of soldiers to send or whatever, it wasn't very encouraging for sort of, from the perspective of getting the Iraqi army to sort of shoulder security burdens. So I think there are still big questions about how sustainable this will be, when we leave. It looked like Sadr basically got the upper hand, and Maliki had to kind of sue for some sort of tentative peace while he could, which raises kind of all sorts of questions going forward. But I will say this: I mean, I think that if you are a Democrat and you think we basically have two choices. One is a sort of interminable occupation, which you're not prepared to accept, or to get out relatively soon. I think, on some level, there is an obligation to be somewhat honest about the fact that if you accept choice B, which is get out fairly soon, that this is going to be really ugly, and that we are going to backslide and lose some of the progress that we've made. And that's just going to be the way it's going to have to be because of the opportunity costs, because there are other strategic threats that we face, and because you're not willing to accept an interminable commitment. So I think you're right that that this sort of reality poses a very big challenge for Democrats, and maybe they'll be able to sort of fudge it with this sort of semi-incoherent position. But I think you're right. If your position is that interminable or long-term commitment is not acceptable, then you probably do have to acknowledge on some level the consequences of the alternative. Mm-hmm. And there hasn't really been a willingness to do that. You still have this idea that it could kind of, we can have the best of all worlds, which is just not realistic.
Right. Well, let's move on then to kind of the other major news story, or the major news story of our time. The coverage devoted to the presidential campaign is really unbelievable, and of course drowns out coverage of Iraq for the most part. So I guess the question that you posed to me prior to this recording, and I think I'm interested in hearing your take on it before I get into it. But you know, what are the does this endless Democratic primary hurt the party's chances in the fall, or does it help them? There are two schools of thought here. They're basically there's some liberals saying no, this is going to be going to prove to be the undoing, the fact that you have this constant sniping or low-level sniping between the two candidates. And then you have your former editor, Peter Beinart, of Meet the Press recently saying, no, if you look at the academic research, it's not the long primary fights that, you know, contribute primarily to a losing campaign in the end, if the Democrats do lose, say, in the fall, but other factors as well. Where on that side of the debate do you fall?
I guess my feeling is, I think there are two slightly separate questions, but on the question of length, sort of all other things being equal, I find it very difficult to believe that a long contested primary is helpful to the party. And the reason I think that is, while you can think of reasons why a long primary might not be terrible, you can think of very few reasons why it's actually affirmatively a good thing for the party. So, for example, people often say, well, we're generating all of this excitement, we're registering voters in Pennsylvania and Ohio and congressional districts across the country. In my mind, there's a sort of logical mistake there. And the mistake is, unfortunately, I'm getting a little echo here. The mistake is that there are reasons why it's not a total disaster, but if you could end the primary now, you could basically do all the same things that people say are of some benefit now. So, for example, you could, if you had a nominee, start registering people in Pennsylvania or Ohio or in some down ballot, in some congressional district in Montana, say. So there's no reason that you couldn't do these things if you had a nominee. The problem with continuing the primary is that you have all these other things that are sort of collateral damage. Namely, I think the most serious one is laying the groundwork for attacks that McCain will be able to use against probably Obama, but maybe Hillary if she ends up with a nomination too.
Right. I mean, I'm always kind of, I understand that argument that, yeah, this is laying the groundwork and then McCain will just pick up from there. But it's not as though my reaction has always been, it's not as though these arguments are kind of, were undiscovered before Hillary Clinton mm-hmm. decided to challenge Barack Obama on his inexperience. I mean, it's plain. He is, 4 years in the Senate, about, not even, really. And mm-hmm. and so, it doesn't take a genius to discover that that might be a line of attack against him. The same thing with, Hillary Clinton. It's, she could remind, for she's a polarizing personality, disagrees with that, and she, would remind voters that, maybe not everything about the 1990s is exactly what we want to return to. Mm-hmm. So I'm always skeptical of people who kind of say that this, it's giving McCain ammunition. Republicans mm-hmm. have plenty of it otherwise. I do think, actually, though, this has been a bad time for McCain. I don't think he's using this opportunity as he should, which is to bone up on domestic policy and try to get a handle on the types of arguments he's going to make about, the economy, about, how is he going to shift on immigration, how is he going to deal with that issue? What does he have to say about education? He has a health care policy. He doesn't really discuss it much. All these issues that he really needs to start assembling, a portfolio of ideas on. Instead, he's been touring the country, giving speeches about his obviously compelling personal story, and trying to remind people of who he is, where he came from. Now, it's kind of irrelevant on one level. No one's going to remember McCain's biography tour. Everyone is focused on the Democratic fight. But I do think it's opportunities lost for McCain.
I guess I'd say two things. One is that it's true that it's not as though McCain wasn't going to figure out or stumble into the experience argument against Obama or the sort of less than trustworthy bad things we sort of dimly remember about the 90s argument against Hillary. I think the problem is that when McCain can basically cut a commercial in which Hillary Clinton says of Barack Obama, you know, or says, I'm qualified to be commander-in-chief, John McCain is qualified to be commander-in-chief, Barack Obama isn't qualified to be commander-in-chief, it's a sort of devastating attack and much more credible than if McCain were to say it, because you expect the Republican nominee to say such things about the Democratic nominee. But to have someone in your own party essentially say the Republican is more qualified in this race than the Democrat to be president seems like a much more damaging allegation. And it just lends weight to a charge that would certainly be a serious one, but not necessarily as devastating. I do agree with you, though, that I don't think McCain has made the best use of his time here. I mean, there has been some sort of vague attempt to consolidate the base, some of it ham-handed, particularly with some of the sort of right-wing evangelicals that he's courted, Hagee in particular. I think you're right. I think his time would have been well spent sort of filling out a sort of policy team, boning up on the areas of the sort of policy debate that he's admittedly, he himself has admitted that he's somewhat weak in. But ultimately, I think this just is sort of another argument for the opportunity lost by the eventual Democratic nominee. I mean, if Obama were already the nominee, he could really be sort of framing McCain as someone who's kind of clueless and out to lunch on domestic policy. You know, McCain is stumbling, and the Democrats aren't really able to take advantage of it. He's able to sort of stumble off in obscurity, whereas, I think that if you sort of lay the groundwork now of this guy as a sort of either, you know, ignorant or just not particularly interested on domestic policy and hammered away at it for 6 months, it would be a pretty powerful frame, by the time you got to the fall. So I think even, you know, the argument that McCain is not maximizing his time out of the spotlight is actually an argument for why it would be nice if the Democratic primary had already ended.
But, you know, it strikes me, I mean, we say that it's nice that the Democratic primary, you know, it would be nice if the Democratic primary had already ended, but the people to blame for that are the superdelegates, right? I mean, basically, when I look at the Democratic race, I see two competing coalitions of voters who have basically battled each other to what's more or less a tie. I mean, Obama does have the advantage in pledged delegates. He does have the advantage in the popular vote. And it's unlikely that Hillary Clinton, even if she wins big in Pennsylvania and Indiana, for example, is going to be able to make up that difference. So basically, you have a tie. And the tiebreakers in the system are supposed to be the superdelegates. Now, why the superdelegates, the uncommitted superdelegates, who if they went to Obama en masse would signal that the nomination, this fight is over, why they haven't done that I think is pretty interesting. And I wonder about your opinion. My guess is that they're still a little bit leery that they don't know everything about this charming senator from Illinois who's come out of nowhere to be, you know, the front runner for the 44th president of the United States of America. Is that your take, or are there other reasons they want all the voting to go down before they make their decision, or what?
I think that there are two things that you put your finger on. The superdelegates, you know, some more than others, are worried about, appearing to be these sort of this set of party elites who comes in and imposes their will on the voters. I mean, I think that argument is overblown at times, but, you know, there are a lot of people who've supported Hillary Clinton who feel very strongly about her. And if it looked to her supporters, particularly, you know, certain working class whites and, you know, middle-aged women, that the party elders were coming down from on high and determining the nominee, sort of against the will of the voters, then that could have repercussions. I think there's no question about that. As I said, I think there's more of a sensitivity to that than is justified, but there's some kernel of truth to that argument. I think you're right. I mean, I think the far bigger question is, Obama looked in February, like he was going to be able to begin to poach, to sort of play on Hillary's side of the court. He was making progress among working class whites, in particular, particularly white men, and it looked like he was going to start to break out of his the coalition that he'd kind of put together before that. And I think Ohio and to some extent Texas raised questions about that. And the thinking is, among superdelegates, I imagine, and I've talked to a few of them, is that if Obama were to lose Pennsylvania by, say, 20 points, and then turn around and lose Indiana and even North Carolina, where he has some obvious advantages, I think you would start to wonder about this guy's viability in a general election. I mean, I think, you know, most people in the Democratic Party believe that if Obama is able to hold Hillary to an 8-point, 10-point victory in Pennsylvania, then it basically suggests that he'll do well enough among working class whites in the state to be able to hang on to it in the general. If, you know, if he loses by 20, it probably means he's losing whites by, you know, more than 30 points in that state. Then you really start to worry about whether he's going to be able to defend it against McCain, or even if not, whether it's just going to consume so many resources that he'll be pinned down there and unable to sort of expand the map in the way that he's promised to do. So I do think there are concerns, and I think those concerns are actually probably justified, though I think they will probably be resolved after Pennsylvania, and yet the race itself probably won't be resolved until June.
Yeah, let me ask you just quickly, I mean, it's unlikely at this point, but if Obama does win Pennsylvania, do you think Clinton will be out by the end of this month or even by mid-May?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so, I think it's an outcome that no one expects, yeah. But and precisely because of that, it will have very important consequences.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree with that. You know, you mentioned something to me in an email that I was struck by. The conservatives, you say, who seem to respect Hillary, and then your example was Karl Rove, versus conservatives who seem to like Obama, and then there are several examples of that, you know, David Brooks, Doug Kamich, the law professor, and you say John O'Sullivan, who, I think he's favorable to Obama, but also has some issues with him. This for a liberal, it must be interesting to kind of observe the various conservative splits when it comes to the Democratic primary race. Why don't you give me your take on them, and as a conservative, I'll give you mine.
I mean, I guess I've thought a bit more about the conservatives who seem to favor Obama, because, as you say, that seems to be a more widespread phenomenon. And Kamich and O'Sullivan seem to have a sort of similar view, and I guess Brooks has touched on this a bit, but O'Sullivan sort of has laid it out in some detail, I think, and that is Obama as a sort of Reagan-esque figure. And I think the thinking is that the symbolism of an Obama presidency would be very powerful, not just in this country, but abroad. And, you know, sort of Reaganites are the kinds of people who think that symbolism matters in politics, and that the image that America projects abroad is a very important one and can have sort of real world substantive effects. And I think these guys sort of very honestly think that that Obama, you know, offers this hope of kind of restoring America as this beacon to countries abroad in much the same way that Reagan did. And you could even sort of extend the analogy a bit, that Reagan sort of took over after sort of an extended period of malaise over which the ineffectual Jimmy Carter presided, and all of the indicators were sort of headed in the wrong direction, and Reagan sort of renewed American self-confidence and projected that self-confidence abroad. I think there's an idea that Obama could do the same thing for the country and for the country's self-confidence after this long period of malaise. Right. So that sort of fascinates me, and it fascinates me that the sort of belief in symbolism and imagery and self-confidence, these sort of airy notions, is something that kind of transcends, that these conservatives believe potentially transcends party lines or even ideology.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they're wrong. I don't think Obama is a new Reagan. I think he's a Obama.
Right.
And, you know, if he's Reagan, he's certainly Reagan, a Reagan who hasn't shown any appeal to Reagan Democrats, at least in the primary, and we'll see whether he's able to hold them in the general election. I think what we see with conservative favorability to Obama is a function of conservative antipathy to the Clintons. And if you talk to conservatives who were around in the 1990s, I wasn't in Washington in the 1990s, but the level of loathing of the Clintons and their style of politics and their narcissism, so attributed, is really quite stunning. And so, even as we see in several parts of the in the Democratic electorate, a yearning to move beyond the Clintons, there's certainly that case. That's the case in conservative Republican circles. I do think there is some kind of second look at Obama. You know, whether the appeal of a guy who certainly, I mean, would be a huge milestone to have him be president, and who the world would be, I think, pretty shocked that he was president. We see that in some of the reporting. The Times, I believe maybe 2 months ago, did that fantastic story where they went and had correspondents all over the world interview the people about Obama and what he represented, and there was really kind of palpable shock and good feeling, I think, among a lot of people in the world. I think that's the case, but it always comes down to policy, and so there's a kind of a conservative backlash, I think, ongoing to Obama, as more of them start realizing that, yeah, this guy talks a great game in terms of post-partisanship, you know, post-ideological politics, but at the end of the day, he's an unreconstructed liberal, and so this backlash among conservatives, is, intellectuals at least, is just beginning to happen. You saw like Peter Wehner, for example, who had an op-ed piece recently in the Washington Post that was much discussed about conservative like of Obama. He's now taking a much more harsher stance on Obama, examining his positions in the Iraq War, for example, or, of course, post Jeremiah Wright. Other conservatives, this backlash, I think, is going to continue, and there'll be, I wager, more McCain Democrats in the fall than there are Obama Republicans.
So I'm curious. So we touched on conservatives and Obama. I was, as you alluded to in leading into this line of debate, you know, there have been some, many fewer conservatives who seem to now have this sort of grudging respect for Hillary. And
right.
Karl Rove is probably the most prominent one. He had this interview with GQ. Lisa DiPaolo, I think, was the interviewer,
right.
Where he basically sort of evinced this kind of respect for Hillary and for the Clintons. Do you think that's sort of entirely strategic, that basically Rove is basically trying to knock Obama now that he looks like he'll be the nominee, and kind of tout Hillary now that it looks like she's going to lose? Or is there something genuine there, and is there you know, is there the flip side of the conservative sort of fear and loathing of the Clintons, this kind of respect for their political powers and for their ruthlessness and for their effectiveness that conservatives almost admire in a way?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't think Rove had any secret motives. I think he was just saying that he respected Clinton a little bit more. Certainly, I mean, if you just look at Clinton, I respect Hillary Clinton a great deal. I mean, if you just look at, you know, who has the better record among the Democratic candidates of reaching out across the aisle? It's not Obama, it's Hillary Clinton. I mean, she's sponsored legislation. I mean, she's reconciled herself with Newt Gingrich and even Richard Mellon Scaife, of course, to much controversy. I think there's a recognition among some conservatives now, having been removed from the Clinton era, that if one of these candidates is going to be president, it probably ought to be the known quantity, which Hillary Clinton certainly is. I mean, if she's anything in public life, she's a known quantity. She's been around for a long time. And, of course, the Clinton record, if you look at it, is one, I think, from a distance, most conservatives recognize as a more or less conservative one. I mean, Bill Clinton, even though he began on a liberal footing in his first term, he ended up being a president who signed into welfare reform and abolished the aid to families with dependent children. He cut the capital gains tax in the budget deal of 1997. This is a guy who sponsored free trade, NAFTA. So I think there's that as well, that if you recognize that with the Clintons, not only do you know what you're getting, but you know that you're probably going to be getting a politics of triangulation in which conservatives and the other side, the Republicans in this case, will be able to reach some forms of compromises and perhaps even score a few victories. In fact, those reasons that I just outlined are the very reasons that the Netroots, for example, loathe Hillary Clinton and have embraced Obama. And so I think it's very wrong for conservatives to like Obama, or not to like him. I like Barack Obama a lot, but to support him, because the movement that he would bring to power is one that views conservatism not only as a bad public policy force, but just a bad force in American public life. Now, the paradox here, though, if I could just get aside, is that one of Hillary Clinton's most vocal supporters, or at least, not a supporter, but an ally, is Paul Krugman, who is very much anti-Obama, yet at the same time, extremely anti-conservative, anti-Republican. I think he's the exception that probes the rule, as the saying goes, and not necessarily disproves it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I think Hillary's, Hillary has this sort of bizarre coalition when you think about it, because, it has to do with her worldview, which is sort of interesting and kind of complex. On the one hand, as you say, the Clintons were the sort of masters of triangulation and willing to co-opt, key portions of the Republican agenda. On the other hand, she does make herself out to be the sort of hero of working class people and take on a sort of increasingly orthodox, even sort of populist economic agenda. And her criticism of Obama at times, which Krugman sort of echoes, is that she's too timid. He's not basically ambitious enough of a liberal on domestic policy, right. Healthcare in particular. Though obviously she sort of attacked him on NAFTA and generally she's sort of on the home mortgage crisis, she again it sort of attacked him for being too timid. So, right. So even though there's this sort of residual belief that the Clintons are basically moderates at heart and sort of willing to kind of throw liberals overboard and make common cause with conservatives, the evidence of the campaign is actually that she's a relatively orthodox liberal.
Right, or at least wants to campaign as that, as she's been losing the nomination to an orthodox liberal. I mean, there's no greater evidence of this than the sacking of Mark Penn, right? I mean, what Mark Penn's great crime was supporting, working for this free trade agreement with Colombia, which Hillary Clinton would have supported, I think, if it had come up for a vote, say, in 2003 or 2002.
No question.
Yeah, and now she can't. She doesn't support it, and she probably can't because of the political context in which she's operating. And we just find out today that, of course, Bill Clinton has some links to this Colombia Free Trade Agreement. It's an interesting, the political story of the Clintons is always... is always interesting, but it looks like it may be coming to a close. I'm ready to end it there if you are, Noam. Is there any closing thoughts or things you wanted to
that sounds about right. I mean, the one thing I would say is I do think conservatives and maybe the country sort of thinks they know the Clintons sort of based, or Hillary based on the Clinton presidency. And, there is some reason to believe that there are ways in which Hillary may actually be substantively more liberal than her husband and sort of less prone to triangulation. But I think, it, as you say, maybe it's sort of academic at this point because we're never going to get a chance to see, so...
Absolutely. Well, thanks for the great dialogue, and I hope to talk to you soon.
No problem. Enjoyed it.
Take care.